a lot of online retailers offer free product returns. And the buy, try, return method of shopping is a common tactic. Maybe you buy 6 pairs of shoes, keep the one you like best, and return the rest. But it's not as simple as putting those returned products back on the virtual shelf. Our next guest recently wrote a piece about the booming reverse logistics industry and what happens to the stuff we return and whether or not it's actually sustainable. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you rely on returns when online shopping for stuff like clothes maybe or shoes? Are those returns usually easy and free? Have you been caught in a situation where it's not? And do you have questions about what happens after you return the thing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Owen is an author and staff writer at The New Yorker. He covered the reverse logistics industry. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Give us a sense, please, David, of the scale. How much of the stuff we buy ends up being returned?
Oh, it's a ton. It's hundreds of billions of dollars worth every year. And it's especially true with apparel. Apparel is the tricky one. It can be like 40% of online purchases of clothing and shoes that are returned.
And I think the assumption sometimes is that, okay, if I'm returning a thing and not because it's defective, it's in fine shape, I just changed my mind or it didn't fit or whatever, no problem. It'll just go right back to the store and they're going to sell it to somebody else. The reality, reading your piece, is a wee bit more complicated.
Right. It doesn't happen very often. You know, I remember when I was a kid and my mother would take me to Stride Rite to buy school shoes. And if I tried on pairs that didn't fit, the salesperson would just put them back in the box and put them back on the shelf so another obnoxious 10-year-old could try them on. But that doesn't happen with online purchases. And I attended a conference back in January in Las Vegas of the Reverse Logistics Association, an association of people who deal with what's called the reverse supply chain, the stuff that goes back. And there was a returns executive from Amazon there. And I asked him, he said, when returns come back, they subject them to what's known in the reverse logistics world as triage. They analyze their condition. They decide what can happen to them next. And I said, in this triage, how big is the slice that goes back on the shelf? And he said, it's minimal. You know, it's very, very small. And the reason is that with online purchases, they don't know what's happened to the items while they've been in the hands of consumers. They don't take risks. And unless the product is unopened, clearly unopened, still packaged, still sealed, it's not going to go back on the shelf. It will drift off into this other universe.
That sounds really expensive, David, to a company. And I'm guessing it's more than just a spirit of great generosity driving these very forgiving return policies. Are we ultimately paying for those easy returns in some other way?
Oh, sure. We're paying for them in the same way we pay for so-called free shipping. Somebody pays for it in the end. So there's convenience that we get. I think we pay for it both in the cost of the prices of the things that we buy, and also in the quality of the things that we buy. If to keep prices attractive, quality often has to fall. And it's interesting that you would think that if you were a brand owner, if you're a manufacturer, if you're a retailer, you would want to cut returns to a minimum. But to a retailer, a customer who frictionless returns make customers happy, and retailers want customers to be happy. So on the one hand, they're sort of mildly discouraging returns by doing things like adding reshelving fees, restocking fees to stuff you send back. But on the other hand, they're constantly trying to make it easier. So Target now has drive up refund windows. The two biggest retailers in the world are Amazon and Walmart, and they also have two of the most generous return policies. So there was a business school professor who told me if you tighten up you make your return policies more stricter, more prohibitive at great risk, because if you lose customers, you don't get them back.
And it seems like we as customers are demanding this. At one of the conferences you went to, somebody asked a bunch of actual sustainability experts. This is like the punchline to your piece. I'm sorry to spoil it. Hey, if I made a computer that's better quality, long-lasting, durable, it's a way better computer than the one you can get at the same price, but that other one has free returns. I have no returns. Were people willing to buy that computer if they couldn't return it?
No, they all said no, and they were all MBAs in an environmental in environment program at a major university. So it's something that that appeals to people, and it's a cultural thing too, because it's not surprising probably that we Americans are the world's leading refund seekers. It's not universally true. Consumers in Japan return very little, like vanishingly little. It varies from country to country, and also it's the pandemic. Everyone told me that the pandemic had accelerated both online shopping and online shopping returning by several years. During the pandemic, when stores were closed, people bought more stuff online. They couldn't try clothes on in dressing rooms. They couldn't try out appliances that they wanted to buy, or power tools or things like that. And so huge quantities of all that stuff went back, more than had been the case before the pandemic. And now, even now that stores are open again, people still do it, and they do it in brick and mortar stores, maybe only at half the rate that they do online, but still much more than they used to.
Talking to David Owen, a writer for The New Yorker, about a big piece he wrote on the economy surrounding returns, product returns. It's huge. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you buy a bunch of the same-ish thing with the intention of returning all but one? Do you find yourself returning more products than you used to? Or are you careful? You pick that one thing that you know you're going to like. Do you work in the industry that processes these returns? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, what happens to the returned stuff? That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with David Owen, author and staff writer at The New Yorker, about what happens to the products we decide to return. You can share your experiences returning products if you do it more than you used to. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, David. Now, your piece in The New Yorker about our product returns opened my eyes to this industry, the reverse logistics industry. Can you talk about some of the things you saw out there? I had no idea that most of this existed, I gotta say.
Well, it's still evolving rapidly, and someone told me it's a highly entrepreneurial industry, and it is. You think there's all these products that go back. It's money to somebody. It's a nuisance often to the retailers that sold it in the first place, but there are people who saw that they can make money from it. So although people will complain that the big online retailers have put mom and pop stores out of business, there has been this whole rise of mom and pop type stores that sell returned items, overstock items, refurbished items, some including big chains. So I visited a company in Georgia that handles returns. It contracts with brand owners to handle their returns. It refurbishes many. It then sells them in a secondary universe, outlet stores, discount stores like Ollie's, places like that, where you can buy and often return refurbished items that somebody else returned and they were repaired and put back into the kind of shape that they could be sold again.
Those first level processors in this reverse logistics industry. Now, I probably can't go up to them and buy a shirt, right? Like, could you talk about the volume that first level where they're sorting stuff out, that next step of triage, it's like, what kind of volume are they selling in?
Oh, apparel is the hardest. And someone pointed out to me at this conference that I went to in Las Vegas, she said, you'll notice there's no one here from the apparel industry. The reason is that the return numbers are really high, like 40%, and yet it's clothes are tough. They go out of style quickly. People send them back in terrible condition. They're one off. So you send back, you could end up with one of each of a bunch of different items in different sizes. It's hard to resell them. you could go online right now and bid on entire truckloads of returned clothing and pay maybe 10 or 15 cents on the dollar, and in the hope of making, you know, 20 or 25 cents on the dollar by picking through it and finding things that you can resell. And that's true of kind of, you know, you can do, you can buy Amazon returns by the pallet full, by the truck full. You can buy individual items. There are places online where you can do all these things, but you, when you do that, you take on a risk that, you know, it turns out maybe that the that there was a reason that the person returned the indoor basketball game that you've got your eye on, or the air rifle, or the hundreds of items in a truckload that you've decided to bid on. So it's a But it's an interesting world. I didn't actually bid on any of these things, but I was interested to
watch.
You
didn't need a truckload of returned shirts?
Right. There was a 2-pallet load of returned sports type items from Amazon. They were, you know, very few multiples of any item. There was no guarantee that any of them still worked. And yet it attracted a couple of hundred bidders and ended up selling for, I don't know, for a fraction of, for 15 cents on the dollar, say. But I saw another, there was a load of returned designer shoes in their packaging. And the estimate of the original retail value was over $100,000, and nobody bid on it. You know, a couple hundred people looked at it and nobody wanted it.
Something that really struck me is sometimes when there's a defective product, say an appliance or something, sometimes the first time the company, the manufacturer, figures out there's a consistent problem in the field is they hear it from these companies that process returns. What did you see?
This particular company in Georgia that I went to, they told me that the main thing, that their main business is selling information to brand owners. And the most valuable thing that they do is information. It's not reselling the items, although they prepare them for that, but it's letting them know what went wrong. And they said, you don't really understand a product until a consumer has had their hands on it. So they sometimes found out after just 3 returns that a particular high-end appliance had a serious problem, and they actually worked with the factory, which is often the case, was in China. They worked with the factory to design a fix. And so they spotted a problem early and were able to participate into solving it before it became a huge, before it became a catastrophe.
Now, I got to admit, David, I'm kind of old fashioned. I overthink most of my purchases. I'm probably not going to return something unless it, you know, catches fire or something like that. Am I a dinosaur? Is this just the way people shop now? Like, I'm going to buy lots of stuff and know I'm going to return a certain percentage of it?
You know, I think it is. I think it's younger people are more likely than older people are to do this. And I think we've gotten bad about reading instructions. Men have always been bad about reading instructions, but often appliances go back because people tried to use them, or power tools.
You've got a hilarious example, the power sprayers. You got to share that.
Yeah, right. It was pressure washers, and where people don't, you're supposed to, you have to hook them up to water before you turn them on, but people will often turn them on. And I said, you know, couldn't you solve this by putting some kind of some kind of detection device in the water tank? And they said, no, that would probably be too expensive. It would just be another label, warning label on the power washer. And, you know, people who don't read instructions don't necessarily read warning labels either.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you.
That's David Owen, author and staff writer at The New Yorker. We talked to him about what happens to the billions of dollars worth of stuff we return to online and in-person retailers every year.